And our sermon text today is Song of Solomon, chapter 6, verses 4 through 12. You are beautiful as Tirzah, my love, lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners. Turn away your eyes from me, for they overwhelm me. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have come up from the washing. All of them bear twins. Not one among them has lost its young. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother, pure to her who bore her. The young women saw her and called her blessed, the queens and concubines also, and they praised her. Who is this who looks down like the dawn, beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun, awesome as an army with banners? I went down to the nut orchard to look at the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vines had budded, whether the pomegranates were in bloom. Before I was aware, my desire set me among the chariots of my kinsman, a prince. Fight or flight. Naturalists call this an animal's response to danger. Fight or flight. Species may be created with grace and speed, like many species of deer, or they may be endowed with great strength in order to stand their ground and fight, like the bear. Or perhaps God has endowed other species with adaptations that have allowed them to thrive. Skunks prowl around our chickens looking to snag one when they can, until the geese chase them away, or I can draw a bead on them. They make for good target practice. But oh, what an effective adaptation they have with that powerful repulsive scent bomb, right? It's bad enough to us who don't rely on our sense of smell to survive. What if you have a sensitive one, like dogs? Our dogs snort for days after being blasted by one. Or the porcupine has an effective means of defense, too. Those quills are barbed and they're extremely painful to extract. Once again, just ask our dogs. Humans, too, may not be endowed with exceptional speed or strength, but we do have a particular grace from God, a sentient mind. We can use tools, for example, to enhance our speed. My neighbor tells a story of escaping a bear on his trail bike on one of our ridges many years ago. Or we can use tools to enhance our strength, like a gun to bring down that bear if you can't flee. Or perhaps a mix of both. My martial arts instructor always encouraged us to flee an encounter whenever possible. That's counterintuitive for a martial arts instructor, you know, you would think, but no, he says run first if you can. And use our fighting skills only when there was no other option. But what great skills when you need them. He employed one move of seeming to run from you when you had him cornered, you know. And my first time, I said, I can't believe I have Sensei running from me, right? So I chased him. And as you chase him, he would suddenly stop, put one hand on the floor, and snap a horizontal kick into your gut as you were running right into that kick. And the combination of the force of his kick and your momentum usually meant lights out for you. Now, sometimes as Christians, we too must fight or flee in our struggle against sin and in our warfare against the enemy, fight or flight. And today we will see Shulamith's response to Solomon's second temptation. Has she seen enough? Will the allurements of harem life be too strong to overcome? Or will we see that the answer to the rhetorical question of Solomon, a virtuous woman who can find, is answered in her? So let's move to our text then today. First of all, verses 4 through 7. You now have an outline before you. Verses 4 through 7, 3 points to make today. Solomon's second temptation. Point number one, Solomon's continued flattery of Shulamith is a tedious repetition of what has come before. We're just coming off our second dream sequence, in which we see that Shulamith and the shepherd boy's love for one another is still rock solid, that is, as strong as death, and white hot, that is, the very fire of God, and that it will overcome many obstacles. Many waters cannot quench it, right? True love, biblical love. The first temptation of Solomon and his harem squad has failed. But that does not mean Solomon is finished. No. In fact, he will try a second and a third time to persuade Shulamith that the best life for a daughter of Jerusalem is as one of his wives or concubines in the harem. Note his approach today. Flattery. Again, flattery. The son of the psalmist and poet of Israel, that is David, again resorts to whispering sweet nothings into the ear of Shulamith like a royal Pepe Le Pew. He compares her to Tirzah and Jerusalem. Tirzah was a city in the northern part of Mount Ephraim at the head of a small wadi. It was lush and beautiful, had stunning views of Cana to the north and the south and the west. Jeroboam would later make it the capital of the northern kingdom. And then Jerusalem, of course, was the apple of God's eye, the place he had chosen to place his name forever. Who would not be flattered to be compared to Tirzah or Jerusalem? Or a full army in its pageantry? The most I've been impressed was at John's graduation from West Point, where they pulled out all the stops. They had the academy's marching band and choir, the graduates in their distinctive uniforms, marching in precise formation, colorful flags of all sorts with Old Glory, of course, large and ubiquitous all over the field. It was designed to inspire and impress, and it certainly did. In its own way, it was beautiful. I'll always remember it. Then he launches into a vaguely familiar description of her physical features. Again, maybe you remember. Her stunning windows to the soul, her eyes, so lovely they cannot be gazed into for long without turning away. And then verses 5 through 6 are a kind of digest of Solomon's stump speech to the harem girls. We get the sense, you know, that this is kind of a speech he's found effective in seducing the women of Jerusalem, the girls, the virgins of Jerusalem. And verses 5 and 6 are kind of a digest of his stump speech to the harem girls that we saw in chapter 4. The goats leaping, right? Again with the goats. The teeth like glistening little lambs and ruddy cheeks like pomegranates that need no makeup. The exact phrasing is employed where the speech is quoted. The entire speech from chapter 4, isn't cited, but enough is that we're left with the impression that there's nothing new under the sun, as Solomon might say, even when it comes to the lyrics of his songs. In its context, and we must always keep these speeches, each of the chapters, each of the songs, if you will, in its context. In its context, although the poem on its face may seem lovely and flattering, and you can, you know, quote these lines to your wife in the evening, right, after dinner. Perfectly legitimate to do. But even though it seems this way on its face and is good and efficacious, we are meant to discern in its context that it is flattery designed to seduce a naive, innocent girl, which Shulamith is not, is she? She's not. She is filled with a wisdom that Solomon seems to lack. She heeds better Solomon's own wisdom from the Proverbs, for example. On flattery, Solomon says, a man who flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet. Right? And he's doing that precise thing with the daughters of Jerusalem. And on seduction, he says of the adulteress, he's an adulterer, he says of the adulteress in chapter 5, for the lips of a forbidden woman drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is as bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps follow the path to Sheol. She does not ponder the path of life. Her ways wander, and she does not know it. That's exactly what Solomon is doing. He's following in the course of the adulteress as an adulterer. Make no mistake, harem life is nothing but ubiquitous adultery. And such will be the end of Solomon, right? We know this from the historical books. And such will be the end of his sons and his harem, too, for that matter. Those in the harem not slaughtered in the destruction of Jerusalem or carted off into captivity. Not so our virtuous woman, however. That brings us to point two. In Solomon's second temptation, Solomon's second temptation is where we're at right now. Solomon's harem, who flatter Shulamith, stand in stark contrast to her unique virtue. She is a virtuous woman. Virtue in the sense of our Sunday school lesson a few weeks back. You all know now better that sense of the word virtue, do you not? Why the English translators of the King James used that word virtue, much broader in its semantic range, meaning many touch points of meaning for that word virtue, meaning strength as well as strong character, as well as being a goody two-shoes. That's usually what virtuous means in our parlance, isn't it? Oh, she has virtue. She doesn't sleep around, in other words, right? It's much more than that, virtue, a virtuous woman. We know that now. Stark contrast, the harem stands to her unique virtue. Solomon then compares her to the women of the harem, the queens, the concubines, the prospects in training, that is, the virgins without number. And once more, we get a glimpse of the surface of sin, the gorging of oneself upon the gluttony of transgression offered by the limitless opportunity to sin when there are no restraints. What are the limits to sin when there are no restraints? And we must digress a little bit and emphasize again that the harem, that's the setting, our context, remember? Without the setting of the harem, the cogency, the coherence of the Song of Solomon falls apart. It must be emphasized that the harem was not some noble, upstanding, ancient tradition, which every respectable king instituted for the prestige of his reign. No. Rather, the harem was the product of the excess of man's nature when no restraint was placed upon him. And there were no restraints on the ancient potentates of the East. What will a man do to satisfy his sexual appetites when he has limitless resources at his disposal? Whether human, potentially every young girl in the kingdom to supply, or finances to lavishly finance that pool of girls. What does he do? He creates the harem. If you want to know what a man will do under such circumstances, look no further than the harem. Solomon had that opportunity. He says once again in chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I kept my heart from no pleasure, he says. And today we see that harem impulse too. we see that harem impulse reflected in the proliferation of pornography, which I call the poor man's harem. Pornography is the poor man's harem. In pornography, the fool, and make no mistake, those who habituated to pornography are biblical nabals, fool. In pornography, the fool gets to indulge many of the features of the harem. Many partners, girls of his choosing, sex when he wants, and always the elusive fantasy of human intimacy and pleasure. There is in pornography the fantasy, and that's all it is, of human intimacy and pleasure. Nothing real there. So fathers, warn your sons of the poor man's harem and its traps, and resist the temptation yourself. But Solomon, alas, was no poor man. He had the resources to test himself with pleasure. And he certainly did. But he made no more progress than the poor man does with his pornography. We've seen the bankruptcy of intimacy and pleasure in the harem, not only here, but also in the book of Esther, for example, but here as well. In his effort to win this virtuous woman to the harem, he flatters her by telling her how she excels the beauty of all others, even touching upon the core value of her innocence and virginity, too. This is crass on his part. He touches on that innocency and virginity, that is my dove, my perfect one, the only one of her mother, pure to her who bore her, acknowledging her virtue, if you will. And we've seen twice now, third time now, the center of her virtue, that is the one of her mother's chamber, right? The one where there's safety, where there's protection, pure to her who bore her. What helps make her a virtuous woman is being the only one of her mother, the chamber, dwelling in the chamber of her mother, a reference, an allusion, double entendre here, meaning the womb as well. Okay? So he's going there, even. How many such girls had he won with such honeyed, oily speech? On the one hand, all of these things were also true of Shulamith. This is the irony of it all. All these things were true of Shulamith. Much flattery is, isn't it? That's part of the power to seduce, is that truth is often used for nefarious purposes. The last temptation of our Lord, Satan said, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here. And of course, Christ was the Son of God. For it is written, he will command his angels concerning you to guard you. And that would be true of him as well. The seduction is in throw yourself down from here, right? That's part of the seduction. Our Lord, of course, stopped him short. He said, you shall not put the Lord your God to test. And here, Shulamith is being tempted and tested herself. She is in her period of probation. There's an irony there as well, because in one sense, she's in her time of probation with Solomon, right? Are you going to make a good virgin for Solomon, a good partner in bed for him? We can get you ready for all of that. But you have to be X, Y, and Z. You have to be willing to submit to A, B, and C, right? She's on probation with Solomon. But she's also on probation with God. Will her virtue stand? Will she be demonstrated to be strong in character? Wise in her deportment, wise in her decisions, as well as chaste in her behavior. That's the sense of virtue that we're talking about here. Will her virtue stand? So there's that dual sense to her probation. But for Solomon, truth is being used to subvert the one man, one woman model of marriage. Can harem life do anything else? That one man, one woman model of marriage is being subverted. In her case, the shepherd boy, right? That one man. And if he's successful in doing this, if he is successful in doing this, one more virtuous woman would fall into that grinding mill of the surfeit of sin. That is the harem. And even the voices of the girls of that harem, the young women, queens and concubines, that's peer pressure. That's the essence of peer pressure, right? They come up, the voices come up to call her to the way of the world. Who is this who looks down like the dawn, beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun, awesome as an army with banners, right? Verse 10. So their voices come up. How will she respond? Will she finally succumb or will she rise in fight or flight? That brings us to point three. We're in Solomon's second temptation, verses 11 and 12. Solomon's object of seduction, Lady Shulamith, flees the harem as if in a swift, secure chariot, verses 11 and 12. Shulamith responds to poetry with poetry. Understand, we are dealing with Hebrew poetry here. She has in mind the threshold of her adjuration. The threshold of her adjuration. Remember how the adjuration ends? Do not awaken love until it is ready. Do not awaken love until it is ready. In other words, don't come on to me with this harem stuff. Getting me excited about sex with Solomon, intimacy with him, supposed love with him. Don't awaken love until it is ready. That is, until the time is proper and the partner is proper. That is, your prospective husband in a ceremony of marriage before God and family. Do not awaken love until it is ready. That is, until it is ripe. Poetry. We're dealing here with poetry. When speaking in terms of flora, orchards of nuts, blossoming flowers, budding vines, readiness for love is expressed in terms of its ripeness. This is poetry, okay? Is it time to marry the shepherd boy and man? We've been calling this the shepherd boy thesis, but you've seen from the poem already, he's much more than a boy. Okay? Is love ready? Is love ripe? Is it time to go home and get married? Can you see the poetic motion here? Her desire is to go home. We have seen on several occasions that her life and her love has been compared to a vineyard, too. Twice. Now, this is the third mention of her love life, her heart being compared to a vineyard. And blossoms were metaphors of sexual readiness. Pomegranates were sensuous figures of love too. Is love ready? He's asking. Is love ready? Do not awaken love until it is ready. She's making judgment now in her wisdom. Is love ready? Is she truly Solomonic? She is homesick. The flattery is getting old and predictable. The peer pressure is not working. Harem life is not what it's cracked up to be. She is inclined to flee and return to her mother's chamber in the green, green grass of home, as the song goes. Now, next week, we'll see this confirmed when the harem girls call out to her, return, return, right? She returns home, and they're saying, return, return, O Shulamite woman, right? See that in the very next verse, verse 13, right? Or she's beckoned to return to the harem when she has fled. We'll see this confirmed next week. And verse 12 clinches this for us, although it's always been a problematic verse for translators. A big qualifier here. In fact, so just look at verse 12. If you've got, I went through 11 different translations. All of them widely differing in their translation part. It's always been problematic for translators, verse 12 here. In fact, several call verse 12 the most difficult verse in the most difficult book in the Bible. One translator even goes so far as to call the meaning of this verse unrecoverable to us, known only to the contemporary audience, lost to us. I think that's a little overdramatic. Quite unreformed as well. Although it is difficult enough, though, that almost every translation is quite different from another, sometimes wildly so. So, once again, let me emphasize, that's why poetry, this is Hebrew poetry, poetry is always the last genre of any language to acquire, much less master, okay? Poetry is always the last genre of any language to acquire and master. And this verse is Exhibit A of that. So guys, if you're going on to school and you know you want a thesis for your master's or your doctorate, this would be one of those good problematic verses to handle. But I'm afraid your thesis would go on for about 500 pages if you tried to do it too. But in any case, it does not mean that it is unrecoverable, okay? Now, I don't pretend to understand all the nuances of Hebrew poetry to definitively say what the translation is, but I am certain of the gist of its meaning. I'm certain of the momentum of where it's going. I'm certain of the thrust of how we should understand it. In this verse, Shulamith is telling us that in being caught up in judging whether love is now awakened in her, that love is ready to be consummated, in making these judgments using her wisdom, that it is now time to wed the shepherd boy. She finds herself fleeing the harem as fast as she can, as if in the chariots of her kinsmen. And that's an important word to translate there, kinsmen. The idea of the chariots of her kinsmen, that is the people of her family and village. But now she has the status and standing of a prince, that is a virtuous woman. Okay, an equivalent to the sense of a virtuous woman. She is the prince of this verse. That's not always made clear in all translations. Now, in looking at 11, maybe more, different translations, I found the one closest to the sense and meaning of this verse is found in the Jerusalem Bible of all Bibles. And it translates it this way. Before I knew, and then with an ellipse, right, dot, 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 to give that sense of surprise and pause. You know, like sometimes you wake up and you say, Debbie was saying this just the other day, so busy, she woke up and she didn't know where she was. Sometimes you've been on the road or something, traveling, you wake up and it takes you, 10 seconds to realize what time it is, what day it is, where you are, right? That's the sense of her, before I knew. My desire had hurled me on the chariots of my kinsmen as their prince. That's the translation of the New Jerusalem. And that's about as accurate to the sense of this verse as you're going to get. Before I knew, my desire had hurled me on the chariots. That is, there's that sense of motion and fleeing, okay? Had hurled me on the chariots of my kinsmen, as she's on her way home, right? As their prince. That is, as a leader, as a virtuous woman. So, clear as mud. The sense is that she is fleeing the harem here. And she's back on her way home because, indeed, the time is now ripe. It is time for love to be awakened, i.e., it is time to find her shepherd boy and marry him. And we can say she has successfully passed her probation in the harem. She has successfully passed her probation in the harem. Right? but not as Solomon envisions probation. All right? Not as Solomon envisions probation. Instead of successfully negotiating the slalom gates of his test to join the harem, Shulamith has successfully meditated on the awakening of true love, judging the readiness of love for her shepherd boy in a biblical one-man, one-woman marriage that is rock solid and white hot and endures tests, right? Many waters cannot quench it. These tests have not been able to quench that biblical love. And she finds herself almost unconsciously fleeing the harem to return to her roots. That's the sense of verse 12. I suddenly found myself fleeing the harem on my way home. Love has been awakened. It's time. It's time to leave, Solomon. And I will return as a prince, i.e. a virtuous woman, successfully passing my probation. And in marriage, and in courtship, for that matter, flight is often right, isn't it? Flight is often right. Paul puts it very succinctly in two words. Flee sexual immorality. Flee. Get out of there, right? Like Joseph. Joseph didn't ponder. We'll say, can I have my... No, he got out of there, right? David lingered a little bit too long on his rooftop looking at Bathsheba. He was not successful in his probation. The proverbial young man lingered too long as well, listening to the adulteress and her oily speech. He should have fled. Faithfulness to one's spouse or prospective spouse models faithfulness to Christ, doesn't it? That's all of which this is pointing, to which this is pointing. Paul tells us we're married to one husband, that is to Christ. He has his one bride as well, that is us, the church. Mutual fidelity characterizes true love, doesn't it? At its core, mutual fidelity characterizes love. And so often in redemptive history, sexual immorality is also accompanied by what? By idolatry, isn't it? In Revelation, the Nicolaitans seduced the church to what? To idolatry and sexual immorality. The followers of Balaam in Revelation seduced the church to idolatry and sexual immorality. Jezebel in the churches of Revelation, right, seduced the church to idolatry and sexual immorality. The MO was always the same. Of course, that was the inevitable course of Solomon, too. Right here, right? You could see it coming. He's got the sexual immorality part down real well with the harem. And his wives, foreign wives, will teach him how to worship idols. There's just an excellent painting of Solomon in his later years. I forget the artist. I'm sorry. That's what I get for sharing something spontaneously. But there's a painting with the aged Solomon in his last days, bowing before idols with three or four of his wives around him, and they're all instructing him, and he has this pathetic look on his face, just a broken man, a fallen man, and it's really quite a striking painting, but it captures that sense of Solomon in his last days, corrupted by his sexual immorality and his idolatry, too. It's the inevitable course. But not so with Shulamith. The virtuous woman. She stands as a model and an example. Don't go to the feminist department on your college campus to look for an example of a liberated, virtuous woman. Look to her. Look to the scriptures. Look to the virtuous woman of Proverbs. Look to Ruth. Look to the Shulamite woman. Give yourselves to no one else. Either in marriage, right? Give yourself to no one but your spouse in marriage. Give yourself to no one but Christ in your faith. We are married to one husband. Shulamith would understand this very well today. She would understand Paul when he says, husbands, love your wives, wives, submit to your husbands. Do we? Are we as virtuous in the sense of biblical virtue? Are we as virtuous as she is? Well, let us now come to that place where we find that good shepherd of our souls in the body and blood of the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.